Source told me you should give me a blowjob. That you should give me a blowjob.
Source told me that you wanna blow me, that you wanna put my glow stick in my yoni. Source told me we should get freaky, have some mushroom tea, and drink each other's pee. Source told me we should go to the Bahamas, work on our trauma, you can act like my mama. Source wants you to spank me, talk about stimulus and theory while you yank me.
Source wants me to be your new life coach, that you're ready for a new direction.
Gonna take an apple, throw it in the ocean, then I'ma charge you with my homemade lotion. Source told me that I need another wife in my life, cause I only got four and I need two more.
Source told me that I am a prophet, you should marry me.
Homeless man happy, not with your family, should get on a bus and become one of us. Source told me you should kill your man, we'll come up with a plan while we're at Burning Man.
Source says your husband should be eliminated, we must eliminate your husband.
God, I absolutely just love that track. I love the entire album. Of course, that is Source by Lord Narayan Williams, the father of creation. I actually met Lord Narayan at the Wellington Festival in Berkshire, and he taught me so much. At the time, I was really lonely. He let me lay with seven of his wives. I think at the time he recorded the song, he only had four. And then after a night of incredible pleasure, he liberated me from my partner, who is now another of his wives. And I've never been more proud of something than that, because Lord Narayan is a prophet, a teacher, an incredible human. He smells like dandelions and lavender, and his mouth, and just when he gives you the ceremonial kiss of approval, you can feel energy leave his lips into your body. It blows your, he said something about a snake. It blows the snake in your spine. It shoots up your spine, opens up your third eye. And from that day forward, I have been free. So I definitely hope you will check out his new album, I Am a Prophet, because it is a serious blaster. Speaking of serious blasters, we have a blaster today. Mitch Horowitz is here with us. But before we jump into it, I would like to invite you to check out my Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. Lord Narayan gave me his blessing to create this Patreon, and we have a wonderful community. You'll get access to our Discord server, commercial-free episodes of the DTFH, and once a week, we all hang out together for a few hours, and it's a blast. Again, that's patreon.com/DTFH. I have some shows to announce. I hope you'll come see me at Zany's in Rosemont starting the 8th of September, Tacoma starting the 21st of September, that's at the Tacoma Comedy Club, San Francisco, Cobb starting the 6th of October, Helium in Philadelphia starting the 12th of October. There's going to be more dates that you can find at duncantrussell.com. You can also just go directly to the website of the clubs I just mentioned and get tickets there, and I hope you'll get them in advance, because it fuels and feeds my desperate ego that likes for my shows to sell out long before I get there. It just pumps it up, inflates it, and makes it Today's guest is an amazing author. Got a new one coming out called Modern Occultism: History, Theory, and Practice. It covers all of my favorite topics. We talk about some of them during this episode, but we didn't have time to talk about all of them, so I hope you'll pre-order that book. And if you enjoy Mitch, then why don't you go see him, give an in-person talk and book signing. That is going to be at the Philosophical Research Society in Los Feliz, Los Angeles. Go check him out. See him live. Now, everybody, welcome to the DTFH, Mitch Horowitz.
It's the Duncan Trussell family.
Mr. Horowitz, welcome back to the DTFH. It's great to see you. You look glowy as ever, radiating mystical energy. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm really glad to see you. Your shirt is that a purple shirt? A violet shirt?
It's somewhat violet, I guess
violet.
You would say.
Oh, okay. I'm mildly colorblind, but I like it. And it's great to see you. And I'm crying mirthful tears because of a very funny remark you made before we went
out. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I practically am standing in blood. We just had our third child.
Right.
So there is a very primordial standing in blood quality to
You're
that.
Not sleeping much, I gathered.
You know what? I feel somewhat guilty to say that I have been sleeping well. My wife has been doing the heavy lifting with the newborn because she wants to breastfeed, and which means no bottles, you
okay.
know, and I'm yet to lactate. Thank you, God.
So you're sleeping well.
Feel guilty about it. But Mitch, I gotta tell you, man, I love your writing. You know that.
Thank you.
But your book that's coming out, I am so excited to read because it covers pretty much everything that I'm interested in. Modern occultism, history, theory, and practice. Can you tell me the synopsis of this book? And then let's dive in because I have so many questions for you on this
Absolutely.
Very big topic.
It's a history of the occult from late antiquity up through the present. And my effort was to write a sweeping history of occultism as a thought movement, literary, intellectual, spiritual, cultural. And I worked very, very hard on it. A lot
I
of
bet.
Long days and nights, unshaven, underwear, coffee, no sleep. But it just filled me with euphoria because it's been something I've been wanting to write for a long time. And once the demand hit, I just went with it. And it's been a incredible journey, very arduous and very euphoric.
I mean, it is, I understand why, just based on my attempts at diving in to like getting a little deeper than just what you might like see on the news or just something that might pop up on the internet, but getting deeper into like some of the classic grimoires or trying to find out, you know, where did this stuff come from? I mean, that's what's so fascinating about it. With most other world religions, we can trace it back to this origin point, which usually is some prophet, teacher. But with this stuff, it's like, where is it coming from? It's so fragmented. It's so strange. Can we start there? Does it come from some single point? Where does this stuff emerge from?
It certainly is very fragmentary, and in a real sense, occultism is a revivalist movement. It adapts and seeks to piece together from the threads and fragments that have reached us, the pre-Christian religious philosophies of the Western world. So the religious ideas that swept through and persisted for millennia in Egypt, Persia, Greece, Rome, North Africa, Europe, all these vast nations and vast peoples were united by polytheistic spiritual ideas, which sometimes crisscrossed borders and got shared and intermingled. And then over time were decisively wiped out from the mainline cultural scene, first under Christianity, later under Islam. And as this material was rediscovered in bits and pieces during the Renaissance, Renaissance thinkers who first used the term occult, a Latin term meaning hidden or secret, were piecing together ideas very frequently that had been written down, sometimes in Greek, sometimes in Arabic, sometimes in Latin, in late antiquity. That's when stuff started getting written down, things that had belonged to initiatory traditions, mystery traditions, were encrypted in symbolism, were part of oral tradition. Things started getting written down, Greek, Arabic, maybe a little later on, Latin, that represented forms, these expository literary forms that we Westerners could wrap our minds around. You know, we in the West, which is to say really the modern world in general, couldn't even read hieroglyphs until after 1800, right, when Napoleon, right, invaded Egypt and Syria in the late 1790s. The scribes, yeah, and the archaeologists and the draftsmen that he brought with him discovered what came to be called the Rosetta Stone, and it cracked open hieroglyphs, at least in their most basic expository meaning, to Westerners, to moderns, for the first time. So all of this material was vastly, wildly, completely out of reach, which is why the book itself begins in late antiquity, because that's really where the wellspring, at least of those threads that we have, and they are just errant threads, begins. We in the modern world, we like to think that the ideas that we're attached to, including all the mainstream fakes, are really old, really ancient. They really extend back. And that's, yeah, thematically, but, you know, the Jewish liturgy, for example, goes to the Middle Ages. That's pretty old, and it's very beautiful, yes, but that ain't antiquity. You know, we've lost so much. So when we're drawing upon what we consider ancient ideas, usually these are ideas that got reprocessed in antiquity, late antiquity, and that's the case for occultism. Okay. So we're talking the decades, you know, after the death of Christ.
Okay, let's talk about, there's a grimoire that I was exploring called, I think it's called, I just got into it just because the name sounds so cool. The Picatrix, yeah. Have you heard of this? I think called the Picatrix.
Yeah. One of the most mysterious of grimoires. Yeah.
Very interesting. And the story in the Picatrix, as I recall, and I believe it was related to like Napoleon, like a soldier is wounded, gets taken into a pyramid or something where some mysterious person transmits the Picatrix to him. And they all have these fascinating backstories. Another grimoire that I had, I can't recall the name. I think it was more of a collection of grimoires or a sort of philosophy of magic. The foreword, it said that one of the theories behind where all this stuff comes from is that it's pre-flood technology, that what we have here, there was some kind of apocalypse that hit the planet, and this represents some former super advanced civilization that had discovered all of these spiritual technologies that then were hit by a number of apocalypses, one of them being the whatever disastrous event occurred during the when we had giant beavers. What's that period in time called? I can't remember. The Lesser Dryas period. And so the thing that wiped out the saber-toothed tigers. We still have giant beavers, but they're different now. The point is, the I have one. Are you kidding me? I gotta shave, man.
Giant beaver era, yeah.
But so then it's hit by this apocalypse, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, because this is a foggy understanding. Then it's hit by a data apocalypse, which is that Christianity comes on the scene and they're like, no, fuck this shit. We are burning down your shrines, burning down your temples, burning your teachers, burning your prophets, and destroying all material related to this stuff. Not just destroying it, even in a more sinister way, replacing it with Christian holidays. We are taking this thing and replacing it with something to make it that much more covered up. I mean, talk about a conspiracy, man. This stuff was wiped from the board, which is why it's so intriguing to me. Is that assessment correct, sort of, or are there different conceptualizations of origin points?
No, it's definitely correct in terms of this vast religious tradition being wiped out. It wasn't wiped out altogether suddenly. These things tend to happen in a more fitful start and stop way.
Right.
But the Roman Emperor Constantine converted to a version of Christianity around 312, 313 AD. And that's very frequently seen as the historical tipping point. And that's fair enough. It's true. Although Constantine's Christianity was not the Christianity we would know today, he still combined it. Yeah, he combined it with sun worship. He continued to worship Sol Invictus, the sun god. And in fact, Christian pilgrims to St. Peter's Basilica were still doing ceremonies to Sol Invictus and to Jupiter on the steps of St. Peter's into the 5th century AD until the bishop said, hey, gang, we're going to cut this out now. So
right.
I had a couple of centuries of changeover where somebody might say, I'm a Christian, but still worship Jupiter or worship the local deity or abide in the old seasonal festivals or Celtic festivals or what have you. But in time, of course, the old religions, the nature-based religions, the mystery traditions were largely wiped out. So a book like Picatrix, for example, we don't even know that Picatrix is a Latin title. It's a mangling. It's thought to be a mangling of the original Arabic title, which might have been the progress of the sage. But we don't even have so much as the original title anymore, much less a firmly agreed upon author. But it seems to have been produced in Arabic in late antiquity or the early Middle Ages. There's a lot of astrological material in there that influenced astrology. Western astrology as it developed during the Renaissance. So it's an important book. But it just gives you a sense of the disadvantage that we're at historically. We don't know the title. We don't know the author. We think it was originally written in Arabic. And that's leaving aside how arcane and difficult the book is to modern readers today.
Yes.
So we're really on our knees peeking through a keyhole. And this is our past. This is our foundational past. We're really on our knees peeking through a keyhole, and this is our past. This is our foundational past.
Yes, that's to me what's so incredible about it is that it has this wonderful combination of things. The first being, these books are considered just by some people holding one, looking at one, much less opening and reading one is a pathway to demonic possession, insanity. So this, of course, for any teenager, that's how you get into it, is because if your parents are Christian and they tell you not to read something, you're like, holy shit, I gotta read that, what is that? Then you begin to explore it, hoping for some kind of Necronomicon experience, you know,
right.
you want your dog to start floating, I don't know, anything. And you realize you might as well be looking at like blueprints for motherboards or something. It is astoundingly confusing.
Right.
The rituals are often, just to conduct one, it seems like you would need an undergraduate degree in like ancient alchemy or something like that.
Yeah.
And you begin to realize that, it's not just that you recite whatever the particular translation of Arabic is in whatever particular book you stumble upon, but there are all these precursor things that you have to do that make zero sense. In other words, completely confusing. So is there a simple sort of through line that you have discovered that summarizes whatever this ancient religion, philosophy, culture, movement was? Well, is there anything they all have in common, or is it just like a shotgun blast of data from prehistory?
There is commonality, and I think that commonality can be found within aspects of Hermetic literature. Hermeticism was a modern term for philosophy that grew in Alexandria after the death of Cleopatra, after the death of Christ. It's the point at which Greek scribes began writing down ancient Egyptian philosophies, symbolist and oral philosophies in the Greek language. And some of that material has survived. And that's our time capsule. That's our throughway. The point of commonality that unites all these disparate and complex philosophies, I would say, is the Hermetic dictum, as above, so below. It's the principle of correspondences, that everything that the individual experience corresponds to something else in an unseen realm, corresponds to some other experience that exists extra-physically. Maybe in an extra physical connection between two people, that sympathies are not just a question of emotions or physical proclivities, but there's actually hidden tendrils of connection between individuals, between the individual and nature, between the individual and cosmos, which, for example, will get expressed through astrology. There are hidden connections between different substances. Everything exists as a polarity. So a core substance is, in its essence, a fine substance if you can figure out how to perform the act of transformation. Mm-hmm. And this is also true of the psyche. This is also true of our emotions. So this idea of correspondences, as above, so below, appears in Hermeticism. That's the through line. I would say that got expressed in Western scripture through the line in Genesis, God created man in his own image. That is our Western scriptural reprocessing, I believe, of the principle of correspondences, of as above, so below.
Oh,
that's the heart.
Yeah.
That's the
Whoa.
Heart.
That's so cool. Oh, wow. That's so cool. Yeah, that's as above, so below from a Christian perspective.
Right, exactly.
Now, I think another sort of misperception regarding some of this stuff is that it's irrelevant, useless, antiquated, unscientific garbage. But did you explore any of the ways that modern science has evolved from some of these occult philosophies?
There are myriad ways. Everything that we today would describe as scientific was joined to the spiritual in the ancient world. So the root of our own chemistry is alchemy. That's true etymologically, and it's also true philosophically. Alchemy gave way to chemistry. Astrology gave way to astronomy. All the sacred engineering, the symbolism, gave way to the engineering sciences, the architectural sciences. In other words, the construction of sacred sites, from burial mounds eventually to temple complexes, is what first involved humanity in the actual act of physical construction, as above, so below. And in our own era, I dedicate a whole chapter in the book to parapsychology called Science of the Supernatural. And I survey the efforts that modern scientists have made in the West since the late 19th century to try to test for and statistically map out questions of extraphysicality in human experience in the laboratory. Now, in terms of the connection between the occult and science, the very line that I've just used, as above, so below, appears, it appears in different permutations, but its most famous point of origin is from a Hermetic text called the Emerald Tablet, which again is one of these texts from very late antiquity. The Emerald Tablet was translated for the very first time into English by Sir Isaac Newton. And this wasn't even discovered until the mid-20th century. It was found in Newton's papers after they were purchased by the economist John Maynard Keynes. Keynes bought these moldering, dusty papers from the Newton estate, goes through them and realizes, oh my God, this guy created the first translation of an alchemical text, which we refer to as the Emerald Tablet. So you wouldn't have the products of science without the foundation of the search.
This is, to me, the most mind-blowing stuff about it, is when you start finding out that we're talking about the mother of civilization here. This isn't just some shadowy nonsense that people who love D&D are doing. This is the basis for Western civilization. You know, I remember finding out that Tesla, right before his vision of alternating current, was thinking about, Goethe was thinking about Faust in a specific, and then that sent me down a wonderful rabbit hole examining, well, what is Faust? Where did that story come from?
Right.
And then can you talk about that a little bit?
This is why I have this undying love for you. Who else knows?
Thank you.
What other podcaster knows that Nikola Tesla was thinking about Goethe's Faust before cracking open the AC current? Like, who else knows that but Duncan Trussell? You're fucking correct. And it's remarkable because Goethe's version of Faust, first of all, the Faust myth has been around for a long time. And in simplest terms, man sells his soul to the devil and things go badly. But in Goethe's iteration of Faust, which I think is the greatest realization of that parable, in Goethe's iteration, it ain't quite that simple. Faust and Mephistopheles are the intellectual equal of one another, and they sort of do a dance around one another, and they make a very peculiar bargain. It's far more complicated and subtle than just give me your soul and I'll give you all kinds of goodies. They trade off a lot of things with one another, and neither quite gets the better of the other. But the idea is that genius, and this was an ancient Roman belief, genius comes from somewhere else. There is some physical being, intellect, that goes outside of the human form that bestows genius upon us. The term genius is from the Roman plural genii, which means spirits, and that's the term genie in Arabic. And so Tesla's thinking about all this stuff, and Tesla was very forthright about agreeing with the ancients that genius is bestowed from spirits. The term demon itself, of course, people use it negatively today, but in its Greek original, it was a neutral term for spirits, just like genii. It was only later that term took on these culturally conditioned connotations. So here's Tesla thinking about Goethe's Faust, thinking about the nature of genius, thinking about the way that we are infused by inspiration, and boom, this idea comes to him that revolutionizes scientific protocols in the modern world. And boy, people think there's not an occult dimension to life. Well, there's something there.
There you go. There you go. We have this idea that science somehow has separated itself from superstition. We have this idea that science is this metaphysically clean, sterile but when you look at it, you realize, no, it is not. Its roots are in some very, very strange types of cultural earth that most people aren't even aware of. And to this day, look at the names of computer code embedded in it. Daemons, written into computer code is a cult language. It's not only is it still with us today, it is with us every time you turn on your computer, every time you turn on the lights, every time you do anything. All of that has its roots in the stuff that your book is about. And I think that this leads me to another topic in your book, which I am so very curious about, as so many people are, secret societies. The idea that this stuff has been organized a little bit more than maybe is commonly available. There are groups of people who understand what this is and have found ways to use it strategically, but also they do this in secret. They do this outside of normal society. Is that a fair assessment of secret societies?
I dedicate a chapter to secret societies in the book because it's such a hot topic for people today, and there's so much speculation and suspicion and drama and paranoia. The fact is, the modern secret society arose in the wake of an occult backlash following the Renaissance. The occult experimentation of the Renaissance was very complicated. A lot of these occult writers, figures, alchemists during the Renaissance, they had to walk a very, very fine line. Cornelius Agrippa waited 20-some-odd years before a publication of his works of occult philosophy. He got the imprimatur of a bishop. A lot of the occultists who published during the Renaissance sought out the imprimatur, the approval of
approval. Thank you.
Yeah,
I don't know what an imprimatur is.
At the front of the book, it's a stamp of kosher. You know, Duncan is kosher. You're okay. Have a good time.
The way people in the South say empanada.
What?
Give me I want another empanada.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
So they sought out empanadas and they got them, but it was complicated, and so eventually there was a backlash against the occult that, along with other factors, culminated in the 30 Years' War, which is a miserable fucking conflict that devastated Central Europe. And the secret society grew out of that ferment, bottom line. That's where you start to find Rosicrucianism. That's where you start to find Freemasonry. That's where you start to find the Illuminati, which existed for all of 8 or 9 years until the fucking Bavarian monarchy completely crushed them. And we have absolutely no expository evidence whatsoever of the Illuminati, a term that everybody loves to speculate over, existing past that point. But the secret society was a response to oppression that followed the occult experimentation of the Renaissance. After Queen Elizabeth died, after the 30 Years' War broke out, it was not safe to be an occultist in Europe and to have a public career as a professor or clergy or whatever. And you had very few options other than to just retreat into your own life, or if you wanted to find a community, join a clandestine one like the ones I've just mentioned. It's, you know, that's where it came out of. You know, if you hear earth beats, that's the course you're going to find. And those groups performed an important function. They vouchsafed a lot of ideas that might have otherwise gotten lost or completely shunted. Those groups performed an important function. They vouchsafed a lot of ideas that might have otherwise gotten lost or completely shunted.
And to this day, you still find that level of oppression, only the way it's happening now is in scientific communities. There's this dogma against doing any kind of research into what you were talking about earlier. I would imagine that, you know, any true scientist, someone who just wants to find the truth, someone who's just curious to get down to the bottom line of, like, what is this? Is there telepathy? Is there remote viewing? They probably, I mean, and I'm only speculating, have found other like-minded scientists and found ways to conduct their own experiments that won't cut their funding off, because, as I've heard, if you're a scientist and people find out that you are interested in any kind of paranormal anything, then you are going to get labeled as a quack. It could potentially wreck your career.
Absolutely. So there are people with impeccable credentials in the scientific world, living people, the biologist Rupert Sheldrake, the clinical psychologist Daryl Bem, people affiliated with mainstream universities, Ivies, who get the shit kicked out of them on Wikipedia, who get called purveyors of pseudoscience, even though their careers have been conducted impeccably, because they crossed that line and they looked for evidence of the extraphysical in our physical world. And that's the ultimate violation in our mainstream society. The ultimate violation is, you can talk about religion and mythology. You can have a school of theology on whatever campus you want.
Right.
You can process these ideas through poetry. You can talk about psychedelic experiences. You can talk about the mind-body benefits of meditation. But the very instant that you search for physically empirical, replicable evidence in our world of telepathy, ESP, precognition, however conservative your research and however closely you follow the basic methods of science, and science, by the way, a term that gets used with this religiosity, but is nothing more than methodological replication. That's what it is, methodological replication. And if you seek evidence of ESP and you find it and it replicates, you will get branded a quack no matter how impeccable you are. And that's something I'm doing my very best to to work on and to bring out news of, because it is impeding our capacity to search, at least at the university level. It's a problem, and it's a problem we're going to get past, but we have lost probably at least a generation of progress in ESP research because of these social pressures.
What is that? What you see a sort of, what is the Mark Twain quote? History doesn't repeat, but sometimes it echoes. And so here we have an echo. Whatever this stuff is, it is getting slammed now for thousands of years. And the thing that's slamming it seems to be whatever the particular dogma of the day is. First, Christianity is trying to eliminate it. Now, what we call science, which in many ways seems to be mirroring religion, it's a dogmatic way of passing the baton to people you consider to be authorities, even though you haven't looked into the papers, you haven't done your own research, you haven't studied anything. People will just say, trust the science. What does that even fucking mean?
Right, right. It's like saying, do the research. You know, the QAnon people say that. It doesn't mean shit because it's preferential reading. It's crowdsourcing. It's not,
yes,
it's not research that I can trust unless it's coming from a source that I can trust.
Yeah, exactly.
And I mean, look, it's the human problem. We formulate these ideas of what creates a safe world, and then we cling to it emotionally. So there are is a vast subculture of people in our nation, in journalism, in academia, more often found in the social sciences than the hard sciences, by the way, because
right.
I've had conversations with MDs and physicists, chemists, engineers that are wonderful and very far out. It's more in the social sciences where there's opposition to this material. And the social sciences have their own set of problems because the replication of their data is in crisis. And yet people feel afraid that if you introduce the prospect of the extraphysical into the 20th and 21st centuries, you unleash, you open this vortex and people are going to fall into it. And there'll be all this irrationality spreading like wildfire across the country. And that's speculative, that's emotional, that's sentimental. What we need is excellence in our methodology. We can't police outcome. We need excellence in methodology. We need excellence in how we treat one another. We need excellence in a standard of fucking diplomacy that should exist on campus and that disappears as soon as an on-campus figure gets onto social media, where he starts complaining in ways that make fucking Donald Trump sound like Ralph Bunche, you know, and this is a problem. And people have these emotional, sentimental attachments to materialism, and they think they're being rationalistic. When I say materialism, I mean the philosophy that holds that matter just creates itself. Everything is a definable chemical, biological process, and there's absolutely no metaphysical consideration that belongs in the mixture of when we're trying to get to first causes of things. Nothing. And that point of view doesn't work. It simply doesn't work. It's belied by quantum physics. It's belied by neuroplasticity. It's belied by psychical research. Materialism is in a weird place in our culture today because it's triumphed. It's triumphed culturally, but it's failed intellectually. And I think it's going to take us another 30 years to actually catch up to that. And that's part of why the materialists are so angry and so caustic. Because I think there's a realization that they rule the roost in terms of media, in terms of reference sources, Wikipedia in particular, in terms of academia, but they have lost intellectually. And we're in this weird position where the cultural victors are losers intellectually, not unlike the position that the church was in when it was suppressing Copernicus and then later Galileo.
Yes.
It'll work for a time, but it has an expiration date on it.
Okay, I'm sorry to do this, but let me quote Vladimir Putin. I'm so sorry.
Standard bearer.
Only because I watched this documentary before the bullshit in Ukraine started, where he was like having the most bizarro conversation with Steven Seagal. It's just bizarro. You know what I mean? You're just like, what world am I fucking living in right now? But but he did make a pretty good point regarding American presidents. He said, the American president changes. American policy doesn't change. So who's really running the show? And I think as above, so below, let's take that and apply it to what we're talking about here. The face of like who is controlling the data or who is populating consensus reality with its particular symbol set has obviously changed. It is no longer the Pope saying this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, this is true, this is false. It is now a sort of like, I don't know, ambiguous group of intellectuals who know the truth and then disperse the truth to, you know, people like us who don't understand what a fucking hypothesis is or how to actually conduct an experiment or what a control group is or what double blind me or any of that stuff. So let's take it, dumb it down and give it to you. And you just trust this is the truth, but you're looking at the identical thing in the sense that both of these versions of it are weirdly oppressive. They suppress information, they persecute people. They shame people. They humiliate people who, yeah, maybe lots of us did not take statistics. Maybe lots of us do not understand chemistry. Maybe lots of us do not understand how a virus gets into the DNA of a cell or whatever it is. But the reaction to people who are legitimately curious about the universe and who are legitimately questioning whatever anyone is saying, which I've always found to be a very scientific approach to things, let's figure out if it's the truth or not, is aggressive, shaming. You're an idiot. What are you doing? Yeah, do your own research, dumbass, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, go do your fucking research. You can't do research. You know, you peasant. Go back to your fucking job and do your fucking job and shut the fuck up. You know, it's so you see this, I don't know what to call it. Is it the demiurge? You see this bizarre hierarchical archetype that appears that does not want people to veer outside of whatever the particular priest class is that is appearing in whatever time period you're born into. So is there anything in the occult writing about what that is? Is there any identification of this as something? Or is this just part of what happens when power exists in the world? Is this just a byproduct of power?
No, that I think that's a perfect framing of it. And it's very difficult to navigate because on one hand, all of us are generalists. I don't know how to build a suspension bridge and I have no plans on learning, but I have to rest assured that somebody knows how to engineer a suspension bridge and somebody with a clipboard is going to walk over that bridge and certify that the thing is safe. My life depends on it. The lives of people I love depend on it. At the same time, when dealing with contentious issues in science, let's say, I believe in the jury model in the sense that in our society, every man or woman can serve on a jury, can make judgment calls that might be life or death judgment calls, can make judgment calls that make assessments over health claims, that make assessments over violent crimes, that make assessments over liability, things that are as grave and as serious as life gets. And we as a society rightly entrust juries of our peers when the system works the way it's supposed to work to make grave and critical decisions. So no expert, no credentialed source, no demiurge, no archon can come along and tell me or you or anybody else that tut tut, you can't talk about science because you don't do this. So go back to your sandbox and play with your fucking tarot cards or whatever it is you enjoy doing and let the big boys, you know, get to work. And I reject that. And our society does not function that way because the jury system is just a perfect intimate example of how we empower everyday people to make grave fucking decisions. And my contention is that if you know what you're talking about, you should be able to explain how a nuclear reactor works to an intelligent 12-year-old. And I absolutely mean it, and I stick by that. We cannot all specialize in things. It's simply not possible. But what we can do is expect authorities to be able to warrant ideas and explain themselves in ways that are very straightforward, just as I would expect a forensic specialist to be able to talk to a jury and say why he believes something happens the way it did.
Yeah, beautiful. Well said. I've never considered that. It's yes, we just take random people and throw them on a jury and allow them to determine the rest of somebody's life. So that does show that we have some respect for just some basic human ability to parse information and to figure out right from wrong, true from false. That's beautiful. I love that. But you have to wonder. Oh my God, I'm doing a lot of bad quotes today. Here's another quote. I wish I could remember
his name.
No, I won't go.
I believe. You know.
Even worse, mate. Even worse. I can't remember the member of the Grateful Dead, but he was talking.
It was Phil Lesh, wasn't it? That
it
mother.
Was actually Hitler. Hitler was a member of the Grateful Dead. People don't know that.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, the Grateful Dead's been around for much longer than people think. I can't remember. I wish I could remember who it was, but it's a cool interview. They were just sort of talking about LSD, and in this beautiful sort of like hippified San Francisco hippie way. Mm-hmm. Talking about the man, he was talking about LSD. He's like, they didn't want us to go in that room. They don't want us to go in that room.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, obviously the implication being that it's not just that the government is worried that people are going to, like, destroy their minds or something with some illicit chemical, but more that the insight it offers runs counter to most modern day power structures, particularly capitalism, particularly patriarchy, particularly hierarchy. And so you with the occult in these books, you know, the claims that are being made in these books are wild, man. The existence of hyperdimensional entities that you can contact to get information, wealth, treasure, you know, solve problems in your life. The cosmology far outside of what most people throughout history probably had considered was the world we live in. So is there something, do you think there's something there, like in these rituals, in these methods? Do you think that there's something there more than just some fragmentary mythology, but potentially an actual way of shifting into a very different world than most people are living in today?
I do believe there is something there. And I do believe that we have to ask ourselves questions about whether that something is available to us through the forms that it was expressed in a grimoire like Picatrix, for example.
Right.
Like you've pointed out very rightly that if a person looks at a translation of a book like Picatrix, he or she will be blown away by how complex it really is. And the classical magicians like John Dee, for example, who lived in the Elizabethan age, the effort that these people put into their ceremonies is very difficult for us as 21st century people to relate to. They invested so much time and effort and intellectual and physical expense in constructing these ceremonies. I don't know that those efforts are available to the psyches and the constitution of 21st century people. I don't know that we're culturally built that way at this moment. But I do believe, and I do take note, that literally every civilization in human history, and I mean it, from Polynesia to Siberia, people that were separated by vast customs, differences in custom, language, geography, time, they had a similar gambit. They all had a similar gambit for millennia, that it was possible to form relationships to extraphysical forces, very often personified forces, deified forces, that people would represent with the traits of personhood as gods.
Yeah.
And form petitionary relationships with these gods or spirits. Now, and dig this. This is something I hope to write about in the future. Even our pre-human ancestors, Neanderthal beings, Neanderthals, pre-Homo sapien ancestors, they had spirituality. We have statuettes. We have talismans that Neanderthal man used to experience good luck on the hunt. He might use eagle talons or bear claws to experience fertility. There are hundreds, maybe even thousands, of little statues, little figurines that were constructed by Neanderthal man that are called Venus figurines. They're basically fertility statues. They exist everywhere, from the Maya to the Egyptian, every continent throughout human history. So dig it. If Neanderthal man, our pre-human ancestors, our most ancient identifiable ancestors, had a spirituality that we can look at and identify in the forms of talismans and figurines. Be really, really slow. Be really, really slow, I would say, to the cynics to decide that whole vast ocean of human and even pre-human history on this planet should just be wiped away with words like woo-woo, nonsense, balderdash, bullshit. It's like, you fucking sure about that? Are you fucking sure that a protocol that not only extends the deepest human antiquity, but pre-human antiquity should be wiped away with the wave of a hand? Well, you might make a good Wikipedia contributor on some of the parapsychology pages, but I don't think we're a good assessor of the human situation.
Yeah, and you know, not to get like minorly woke here, but I don't think people realize there is a strange element of racism in wiping off the table practices and what I would call technologies of indigenous cultures, like, oh no, they're just full of shit. They didn't know anything compared to us. You know, that's why we went over there in the first place and chopped their fucking hands off, because they were cuckoo. You know, it's like, you know what I mean? Like, really? Really? You're just gonna obliviate the peak philosophy of indigenous cultures because they don't line up with whatever the particular dogmatic
and the Egyptians, fuck did they know, you know,
fuck the Egyptians with your fucking pyramids, fuck your pyramids, they get in the way, now we can't build a fucking hotel there, god damn and your sand.
The Neanderthal man, without him we fucking wouldn't be here. I mean, presumably at some point, you know, there was some cross-section of mating and along comes us. You know, Homo sapien, Neanderthal man, fuck them. You know, what did they know about life?
I just wanted to fuck you, Neanderthal. I don't want to hear about your stupid deities and your fucking teeth you wear on your neck. I just wanted to bang you down, reproduce. Right. It's ridiculous, man. But it's ridiculous. And I think that now we are witnessing one of what I find to be one of those entertaining moments in modern history, which is now we have these whistleblowers coming out of the woodwork and talking, David Grush specifically, talking about how he has evidence and of the U.S. military having access to wreckage, to spaceship wreckage, or to what do they call them now? UAP wreckage. But to me, the most significant thing he keeps repeating is when people are like, they're aliens, right? They're from space. He says, no, non-human intelligence. And so what we're looking at here potentially is one of two things, and both of them are equally bizarre, if you ask me. One, some, I hate to use the word, insane psyop, where they want us to think that they have wreckage for some unknown reason to distract from some bullshit, which is, I think, is an insane idea. The other being, we have begun to quantify what was formerly unquantifiable. We have found a way to quantify exactly what the people who wrote these books that you have written about were pointing towards: non-human intelligence. What's an angel? non-human intelligence. Demon, non-human intelligence. Genie, non-human intelligence. And now maybe our technology has gotten to the point where we can now pick these things up that have been around for a long time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, it's beautifully put. I mean, when you look at the best of the UFO UAP cases, the best, we've got three basic options facing us. One is some unknown super weapon, okay?
Yeah.
One is extraterrestrial, and one is interdimensional. The thesis that I'm personally most interested in is the interdimensional, for those minority of cases that are really extraordinary and evidentiary. Dig this, dig this. At this moment in history, in the 21st century, we actually have better models of interdimensionality than we do of extraterrestriality, I would say. Because the question of how craft could travel such extraordinary distances, I mean, really unthinkable distances, is very, very tough to crack. I mean, we talk of cosmic wormholes and time slips and such, but this is like very, very speculative, theoretical, not illegit, but we actually have better, more finely worked through models such as string theory, still just a model, just conceptual, of interdimensionality, and we have better evidence for interdimensionality emerging, say, from what is the so-called many worlds theory in quantum physics, which emerged in the 1950s and which is very widely written about today in mainstream physics journals and magazines like Scientific American. This stuff is on the agenda, front and center, of people who are involved in quantum particle and theoretical physics. We got better models of interdimensionality than we do of ET. And they're just still models. They're just conceptual. Yep. But that's how I end the book. I talk about the question of a convergence in conversations between people who are interested in the occult or metaphysics and people who are interested in the UFO UAP question, because these anomalies that we're witnessing and that we have some evidence for now are, you know, possibly we might be experiencing slips, intersections, visitations, winks from other dimensions or intersections of time. And lest anyone think that sounds too far out, we know that linear time is an illusion. We know since Einstein that time bends in extreme conditions, conditions of extreme speed, conditions of extreme gravity. And even in our own era, and dig this, even in our own era, we actually know that our astronauts, although they're moving nowhere near the velocity of light speed, they do experience detectable, physically minute reductions in the aging process just because they're going really fast, one of the conditions under which time bends. So lest we say that's too far out, Horowitz is talking about other dimensions, I'm changing the channel, it is actually premised on some of the foundational ideas that exist in modern science going back to the early 20th century.
Again, you see this pattern emerge, which is you have, like, you know, you want to trust a person who can build a suspension bridge. I want to trust the people flying jets above me that are breaking the sound barrier. I want to trust that their ability to see and hear and understand what technologically they're using and how to fly a plane is as good as it can get, because I don't want to think that there's like coked up Air Force Navy pilots who are like, whoa, man, did you see that thing? Looks like some kind of flying tube, baby. Woo. I don't want to think that. I want to trust them. I want to trust them. And when I hear one of them say, yeah, I've never seen anything like it in my life, or you hear in their voice in the recording from the Nimitz footage, you hear in their voice such awe at what they just witnessed. Such, their minds are blown. And the reason their minds are blown, I've never been in a fighter plane, but I imagine whatever your experience is as a fighter pilot is very different from most people's. It's talking about speed. You're experiencing, you know, some alteration in what most people will ever experience in their life, in the extreme, the speed and also dimensionality of it. And so to hear someone who is used to that as their job, have their mind blown, seeing a thing that is defying all of their understanding of the way things move through time space to me, there's a lot there. That's not fake.
Yeah.
That's not a psyop. That's not Bluebeam. That's somebody getting their mind blown by what they just saw. And so then to see those people get shit on by these secularists or whatever you want to call them, these people are like, no, these pilots are high, not just high in the sky, man. You know, I know a pilot. He snorts PCP, snorted PCP on my dick. You know, it's like, come on, man. Like, why? Yeah. Here it is again. It's always there. The moment any of this stuff makes its way under the door of default reality, they treat it like a roach. They just try to stomp it, burn it, get rid of it. That to me is one of the most interesting aspects of the damn thing. It's like, that's the conspiracy to me.
Yeah.
Why? Like, why don't we want this?
I completely dig. And, you know, this science as a social edifice has always had difficulty understanding what to do with testimony. And the scientific culture in this country has always played a kind of yes, I will, yes, I won't game with testimony. We abide testimony all the time. For example, we don't really know how psychopharmacological drugs work. I mean, yeah, we got some models and some decent ideas, but there's no absolute certainty of how this shit works.
By the way, that's my number one field of research. Sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No, not
personally,
at all.
I'm my own test subject in the matter. And I have no idea. I still can't figure it out, but I'm going to keep exploring.
So for psychopharmacology, for analgesics, pain reduction drugs, the person talks to the caregiver and says, yeah, I'm feeling a little better. Let's tweak it. Let's try this. Let's try that. We use testimony all the time, particularly in matters of psychopharmacological care and pain management. When testimony deals with extraphysical experiences or UFOs, then immediately we'll want to throw it out, even when it comes to from sources, people who are ardently trained in how to spot, judge, analyze coordinates. When it comes from those sources, a lot of the scientific edifice doesn't want to honor it. And yet, again, in terms of what succeeds culturally and what succeeds intellectually, the UFO question is now more public than it's ever been at any time, I think, in modern history. There are things happening that I couldn't have conceived of 6-7 years ago.
Right.
The discussion is on the public agenda. And if you want to walk into a room of people who should disagree with one another politically and culturally, just bring up the UFO question, and you'll find any 8 out of 10 people from any background, any part of the country saying, yeah, that's some wild shit. We want to dedicate resources to that and find out what's going on. This is something that should be embraced. This is something that should be celebrated. Seriousness doesn't come from your topic. It comes from your method. And I keep trying to explain that to the skeptics and the pseudo-skeptics who are very deeply attached to the idea of seriousness as something that emanates from subject as opposed to treatment. Seriousness comes from excellence. So let's bring excellence to the query.
Mitch, you are the best. I am so lucky to have you in my life. We are also lucky to have you out there on the front lines. You are a wonderful bridge to connecting these ethereal, misunderstood, eye-rolly subjects with a great methodology and with a great way of articulating them. And I am so excited for Modern Occultism. When does it come out? I see it's on pre-order right now. When can I get a copy of this thing?
Oh, it's out September 19th in print, digital, and audio.
Everybody, will you please pre-order this book? It helps the author so much when you do the pre-orders. Obviously, it's going to be incredible. If you've read any other thing by Mitch, you know he's a great writer. I really hope you all will collectively just dive into this thing. Don't pre-order video games. That's a bad move. But definitely pre-order Mitch Horowitz books because he never disappoints. Thank you so much, Mitch, for coming on the show. Is there anything else you need to plug?
No, just thank you, my man. I'm so grateful, and thanks for creating this space where we can talk about all this.
My pleasure. I can't wait for the next book, but hopefully we can podcast before it's coming out.
Would love it. Sweet. Thank you.
That was Mitch Horowitz. Don't forget, if you live in Los Angeles, to go see one of his talks, get the book signed, but definitely pre-order the book. A big thank you to all of our sponsors, and thank you to all of you for listening. And as always, I wish you a glorious, perfect, wonderful, joy-filled next 7,000 years before the great time of suffering when they come back and take us to the prison planet of Inazale. See you next week. Until then, God bless you.